This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at the Newseum, a museum devoted to journalism and news on the Mall here in Washington, D.C. On Sunday, the New York Times published a 7,000-word article about the relationship between the Pentagon and a group of military analysts, former officers recruited by television and radio networks in the run-up to the war in Iraq to answer questions about weapons and strategy. Some of these men were paid for their commentary, others were not. According to the Times, many of these analysts were given talking points by the Department of Defense. They were invited on trips to Iraq and to Guantanamo Bay, and if they were seen as cooperative with the department's public affairs department, they were given access to high-ranking officials within the Pentagon, including then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Coveted access, especially for those analysts who were also consultants to military contractors. The New York Times declined to make either the reporter on this story or the editor available for this broadcast, but we'll talk with an editor from Harper's Magazine who's reported on some parts of this story, with a blogger for the Weekly Standard, and with NPR managing editor Brian Duffy. One of the analysts named in the Times story, retired General Robert Scales, was on contract with NPR News. If you'd like to know more about the Pentagon's relationship with retired officer analysts or their relationship with the media, give us a call. Our number, 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the hour, Michael Yon, a citizen blogger who spent several years embedded with U.S. troops back from Iraq. But first, the Pentagon's message machine. We begin here at the Newseum with Ken Silverstein, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, who wrote about the so-called surrogates program at the Pentagon on his Washington Babylon blog. And thanks very much for being with us here today.
Thank you.
And I gather this was known officially as the surrogates program.
It was known as the surrogates operation at one point, and then someone inside the press office realized that could be embarrassing, and so they changed the name to Communications Outreach. What the New York Times reported on was really the key component of a larger program. But, yeah, I mean, it was officially known as the surrogates, and that tells you a lot about what the Pentagon was expecting.
What was the larger program?
Well, the larger program was an outreach program that the Pentagon was coordinating that involved not just having these briefings for selected military officers who could help sell the administration's point of view on the war, but also an outreach program to bloggers, to think tanks, to new media. I got a memo from 2006 which described the program. It said there were four components. There was they were going to create and distribute products to new media like YouTube. And I'm not sure, I must say, I'm not sure if they ever moved forward on that. The second component was a rapid response unit. So, if you know, there was some bad news that came out, this surrogates operation would be able to quickly respond and get out the government's point of view, the Pentagon's point of view. There was an effort to get the surrogates on TV and radio, so there was a booking operation. And then there was a fourth component, which really that I think is what the Times was reporting on, which was to provide, I'm quoting from the memos, efforts to provide information and visibility to the surrogate community. And that were, you know, briefings to selected people who they felt would reliably reflect the administration's point of view, the Pentagon's point of view, particularly on Iraq, but on other matters as well.
But even in the Times story, some of the generals, colonels who were at these briefings, well, they did not necessarily go out and parrot the Pentagon's view.
But the overwhelming majority did, which was predictable because of the group of people that the Pentagon was reaching out to, and that's part of the problem. The problem is not with the point of view of these individuals, really, but, you know, you've got the Pentagon press office culling names and selecting people who they felt would reliably, basically, to put it impolitely, parrot the official point of view. And so, sure, you had a few people who didn't toe the party line, and in one case, at least, you know, you had somebody booted from the program. But, you know, if you select overwhelmingly people who you know going in are going to be sympathetic, you get sympathetic points of view expressed in the media, and it doesn't look like it's the Pentagon. It looks like these independent officials, and that's what, of course, makes it more effective.
Another aspect of this was that a lot of these former officers were also military consultants to companies seeking contracts with the Pentagon. Is there any evidence that its relationship with the Department of Public Affairs in any way influenced the issuance of contracts?
Well, I don't think there's any direct evidence, but what I would say is that we all know that when you have a direct financial stake in a point of view, it can influence you in a variety of ways. I, for example, work for Harper's Magazine, and that's where I get my paycheck. I would expect you probably wouldn't put me on to talk about whether Harper's Magazine was the best publication on the market. I mean, and, you know, that's a rather obvious case, but, you know, I think people who have a financial stake, you at least at minimum, and this is a big part of the problem with the program, at least be transparent. At least say so-and-so is a contractor or a consultant to a contractor who has contracts from the Pentagon and operations in Iraq or whatever, and let the public at least know about the situation and let the public decide whether it's fair or not.
Joining us now is Michael Goldfarb, online editor of the Weekly Standard, with us from the studios of WBUR, our member station in Boston. We should note, not the Michael Goldfarb who used to grace these airways with his reports from London. Michael Goldfarb, nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
And I know that you wrote in your blog that, I'm paraphrasing here, but that you were shocked to learn that former generals knew people at the Pentagon.
Yeah, well, I think that was the problem with this article, right, is you have a 10-page article with no smoking gun. There's no real evidence of any impropriety here. The real problem with this was that some of the analysis was bad. But that has nothing to do with their level of access. Of course, generals, especially, sort of flag-level officers, they tend to be Republicans. And not only that, they tend to root for the United States military when it goes to war, which is not all that common in a lot of these mainstream media outlets. So what you had was a lot of people who were parroting the company line. And of course, people are able to look at that and see, oh, this is General so-and-so. That's exactly what they're going to expect. They're going to expect that a general is sort of, that these are his peers who are waging this war. These are his colleagues. And he's going to have generally the same view of things that they are. The problem is we got very bad analysis some of the times, particularly the stuff where they were defending Donald Rumsfeld, who was making a lot of mistakes in Iraq.
Not necessarily just bad analysis. In some cases, you could be charitable and call it spin, and you could be uncharitable and call it misinformation.
I don't think that's true. I don't think there's any evidence here that anyone was doing anything intentionally misleading. If they happen to agree with the Pentagon, that's not spin. There are times when we agree with the Pentagon. I just think that the problem is, look, if you want really good analysis of the Iraq War, you should read the Weekly Standard. And I think that the problem here is that some of these guys were defending Rumsfeld policies in Iraq that were flawed.
And I'm going to borrow a line from Ken Silverstein's blog and suggest that if the Clinton administration during the war in Kosovo had assembled a group of like-minded military officers and given them high-access briefings at the Pentagon, places like the Weekly Standard might not have been too happy about that.
There would have been about five of them. The problem is here is that these people generally shared the views of the civilian leadership at the Pentagon. That's the problem, at least as far as, the folks at Harper's Magazine are going to see it.
Well, Ken, I've used your words. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First off, maybe in a general sense, yeah, if you have a general on air or a senior military official, you might expect them to be more pro-administration, possibly. However, there was something that became known as the General's Revolt. There were a lot of officers who opposed the war either from the beginning or came to oppose the war strongly. And these were not people who were being reached out to by the Pentagon. I mean, they were very careful and very selective in who they were giving these briefings to and who they were offering access to. So I don't think it's a question of, you had 100% support, and so why bother disclosing it? I think there was significant military opposition to the war, and that wasn't reflected in people who were being asked to attend these briefings. And so the fact that, they just said what you'd expect them to say, I'm not sure that's entirely true. I mean, it's what you'd expect this group of people who were hand-picked and hand-selected by the Pentagon to say, but there's a broader opinion out there that wasn't represented at these briefings.
Well, that's first of all, these people were selected by the cable networks, and that's why the Pentagon reached out to them, because they were on TV. And second of all, look, I can't get an email answered from the Obama campaign. Okay, so when you have a point of view that is hostile, to a certain organization or a certain campaign, your access is limited by that. And if you suck up to that campaign or suck up to that institution, then you will have better access. These rules are across the world of journalism. And not only that, but these people are not journalists. They're analysts.
I would say you're dead on. These were people who, I wouldn't have phrased it quite that way as sucking up, but they were people who are overwhelmingly sympathetic and hence more likely to be picked to attend these briefings. I'd also note that some of the people who participated in these briefings had, you know, voiced extreme regret. If I can, you know, there was Kenneth Allard who said that he was an NBC military analyst, and if I can just quote from the Times piece, he said that, now this is the Times saying that he saw a yawning gap between what analysts were told in private briefings and what subsequent inquiries and books later revealed. And Allard says, I felt we'd been hosed. And you had a number of other participants who expressed strong regret because they felt that it wasn't just spin, but it was, in fact, misinformation. So I think there are a number of problems with the program, ranging from the transparency. The Times had to sue to get all of this material. I mean, it's not as if the Pentagon was willing to hand it over. And you also have the problem of the use of taxpayer money to sell a point of view to the public, which is paying for the program. I mean, there are, I think, some fairly obvious problems from the journalism standpoint and also just from the good government standpoint.
Just a few seconds before we have to go to a break, Michael Goldfarb, but was this the government, the Pentagon, propagandizing the American people?
No, absolutely not. Look, you have a bunch of generals. The problem here is with the analysts, that they were too sympathetic to Rumsfeld's point of view, his personal point of view. The problem, though, is not that the government was propagandizing. As we talked about this this surrogates program Ken Silverstein has always had a problem with, the guy who runs that, Jack Holt, he was willing to reach out to anybody who would listen. It's a briefing like any other. Nobody should get all their information from one place. And these men were free to go on television and say whatever they thought in good conscience. Now, if some of them were slightly hackish, you know, that's, if you have a group of 75 people, you're always going to have a few bad apples.
That's Michael Goldfarb, online editor at The Weekly Standard. Also with us, Ken Silverstein, Washington editor at Harper's Magazine. Coming up, NPR's managing editor Brian Duffy will join us to take a look at NPR's relationship with its military analysts. We're live at the Knight Studio at the Newseum here in Washington, D.C., 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're broadcasting live today from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. An article in the Sunday New York Times alleged that some Iraq war analysts have uncomfortably close ties to the Pentagon's Office of Public Affairs. The retired generals and colonels appeared on major TV and radio networks, including NPR. Ken Silverstein is here with us. He's the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. Michael Goldfarb, the online editor at The Weekly Standard, joins us from our member station in Boston, WBUR. If you'd like to know more about the Pentagon's relationship with retired officer analysts or their relationship with the media, our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. From 2001 to 2006, Lawrence DeRita worked at the Department of Defense, first as Special Assistant to the Secretary of Defense, then as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. He's now Senior Vice President of the Bank of America, and he joins us now by phone from here in Washington, D.C. And Larry DeRita, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you very much, and I'll just kind of just start by saying that, you know, my presence today, which I'm happy to be able to join you, is based on my prior association with the DOD, nothing to do with my present affiliation with the bank.
Thank you very much for that clarification. But I did want to ask you, the surrogates program, were you involved in it?
I was. It's something that, a program that existed for several years, including the period during which I was directly involved with it, yes.
And is it, as presented by the New York Times, an uncomfortably close relationship between these analysts and the Pentagon, people who are also consultants to defense contractors who got access to high-ranking officials, including yourself and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld?
These were retired general officers, so these were people that had a significant number of relationships across the Department of Defense by virtue of, in many cases, having spent decades in uniform. So it was, I think, a very natural extension of their public service that they had been reached out to by a lot of news organizations to want to offer their expert views. And it was really the interest that the news organizations showed in these generals, mostly general officers, that made them people we wanted to provide information to. But there was a number of groups like the generals that we had regular interactions with on that basis, experts from across a range of backgrounds and expertise that we tried to maintain regular interactions with so that they had such information as they needed to be as accurate as possible when they were out speaking publicly.
Is it the job of the Department of Defense and the Department of Public Affairs to provide talking points, spin, if you will, to media analysts?
Well, I don't know anything about spin. I do know that we did have an obligation and were funded to provide public liaison, and there were a number of ways we did public liaison. We invited members of chambers of commerce and civic groups from around the country to participate in Department of Defense activities. We had programs for returning military to go speak to schools. There were just a range of programs that were very much in line with our obligation for public information. So, yeah, this was very much in the sweet spot of the kinds of activities we did.
To quote from the New York Times article, and again, we did invite the Times reporter and his editor to join us on this program. They declined the invitation. But to quote from the piece, they're describing a meeting that occurred in the Secretary of Defense's office. Even as they assured Mr. Rumsfeld that they stood ready to help in this public relations offensive, the analysts sought guidance on what they should cite as the next milestone that would, as one analyst put it, keep the American people focused on the idea that we're moving forward to a positive end. Is that, do you think, an accurate representation of the kinds of meetings that you were aware of?
I was in that particular meeting. That certainly wouldn't be the way I'd characterize it. I saw that meeting as I saw most of the meetings when he met with educators, when he met with clergy, when he met with just a range of people from public life and private life, and that was an opportunity to discuss what was going on in the war, to provide his perspective, the department's perspective on what was going on in the war, provide information such as we could within, you know, classification restraints. And in some cases, people were very supportive of what was going on, and in other cases, they were very critical, and it kind of ran the gamut. And I would say, generally speaking, retired military officers generally tended to be more supportive, and this group in particular tended to be quite supportive of what the president and the military were trying to achieve in Iraq.
Is it accurate, as the Times reports, that some who were not necessarily cooperative were then not invited on trips to Iraq or given access to high-ranking officials?
Yeah, I didn't get that, and I can speak for myself, and maybe to some degree for Secretary Rumsfeld, that was not a policy to somehow restrict access to people who didn't agree with us. Lord knows there were, you know, people. Every day there were people coming into the Department of Defense to give us their views that they didn't agree with what we were doing. So I never saw that, and certainly it wasn't the intent or the policy to, you know, somehow restrict access. That's not to say it never happened. It wasn't something that was something we were trying to achieve, and I would have, I think the Secretary certainly would have found on that. That was not the objective of the program.
And Lawrence DeRita, thanks very much for your time. We know you're busy today and about to travel, so we appreciate your being willing to join us on the program today.
Thanks very much. It's an important topic, and I appreciate being able to be part of it.
Larry DeRita, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs during the, 2001 to 2006, where he also worked as a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense. Again, our guests here at the museum are Ken Silverstein, the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine, Marco Goldfarb, the online editor of the Weekly Standard is at WBUR, our member station in Boston. Let's see if we can get a caller on the air. And this is Michael. Michael with us from Eureka in California.
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was calling because I'm a little concerned about the tone of some of the things that people are saying there. It sounds as though they're trying to diminish the effort or the discovery of this information. I was listening yesterday to an interview of a general who participated in this, as well as the head of the CNN office, who he was quite clear that he... He hired the generals that he hired because they were cleared by the Pentagon. The general that was being interviewed indicated that he had red carpet access to Rumsfeld's office and that the time was supportive but became very pessimistic about the activities in Iraq. And when he disagreed with what was happening, he was coerced into keeping quiet and not airing those, but staying with the talking points submitted by the Pentagon or his company that he was invested in. And he made the point of saying that the generals that were involved in this mostly were invested in some company making a profit from the war, and that those companies were threatened by the Pentagon for losing contracts if the generals didn't yield to the talking points submitted by the Pentagon.
Let me ask Ken Silverstein, have any evidence that you've seen that there were threats, pressure involved here?
Well, according to the New York Times, there was, you were invited because you had a predisposition to support the point of view of the Pentagon. There was one instance, I believe, where the Times reported where somebody was strictly cut off. And there were people they quoted who participated in the program who said, you know, your access was dependent on your support for the given point of view that they wanted put across. You know, I would also say in response to Mr. Derrida that, I mean, you know, he's suggesting that, well, it was a coincidence that you know, we had a particular point of view. It wasn't like we were looking for a particular point of view. But that's, you know, the Times certainly seems to have a lot of evidence to the contrary. You have one analyst for Fox News, John Garrett, who the Times got an email of that he sent to the Pentagon saying, please let me know if you have any specific points you want covered or that you would prefer to downplay. I mean, so some of these people, a number of these people, clearly saw themselves as real advocates for a particular point of view. And also, just real quickly, one other thing I would note, you know, this unit, this operation was run by political appointees. This was not the regular folks at the communications office. I mean, you had political appointees who were brought in specifically who were in charge of this operation, and I think that's significant.
Michael Goldfarb, again, I would suspect you're not surprised that retired generals and colonels are advocates for the Pentagon's point of view. Michael Goldfarb, you still there? Oh, we maybe
well,
have
Michael Tout is here.
I'm sorry?
Michael Tout is here from Eureka. Is that who you're addressing?
No, I was trying to get to Michael Goldfarb, who's the online editor at the Weekly Standard. But, Michael, thanks very much for the phone call. We may be having...
Well, I have another question. Another point is that if these generals were acting as active participants in endorsing the activity of the government, then they certainly weren't anyway, as analysts, these people were endorsing and promoting the views of the government at the time. It seems to me that, especially since the military has pretty much admitted that this was a branch of their psychological operations, we have a crime here, and it should be investigated and is very serious. I mean, we have the military conducting psychological operations against the United States people in order to conduct and encourage support for a war that we now know was unnecessary and was based on lies.
All right, Michael, thanks very much for the phone call. Michael Goldfarb, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm sorry. We must have had a technical glitch there, and I apologize for that. PSYOPs against the American people, is that any kind of affair?
If that was in that New York Times piece, this would be a much bigger story. The problem with the New York Times piece was there was no smoking gun. It was a big nothing burger. You had 75 generals, highly respected people, some of whom acted a little goofy. But there was really no evidence of any real impropriety. There's just a faint appearance of impropriety in a few instances. But I think Ken is being a little naive here. If you know the idea that this isn't how Washington operates somehow, and I think that's why everybody's sort of like, yeah, what's the story though? This is to some extent how Washington operates. Of course, out of 75 generals, you're going to have a guy at some point who says, you know, what can I do to help you? He was a general. He worked at the Pentagon. These guys, you know, these are his friends who are commanding troops in the field, and they want to win. So it's hardly, you know, and of course you're going to get a couple, like I think General Bevilacqua was one guy who was very upset by the whole thing. You had a bunch of people here, some of whom saw things one way, some of whom saw things another, but there was nobody who did anything that was, nobody's going to be held accountable because nothing was done that was wrong.
Let's get a question from here in the audience at the museum.
Hello, I'm Maury Stettner from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I have a question. Why would any experienced military official or analyst expect that to be specially invited to a Pentagon briefing, that the information would be newsworthy or straightforward? Wouldn't it be obvious to this seasoned veteran military expert that the information fed to them would be obvious spin?
Ken Silverstein?
Well, I would certainly think so. I mean, I think that was the whole point of the program. Again, you had people who, I mean, they weren't going in expecting that they were going to be given a sort of balanced briefing. I mean, it's pretty clear from what the Times reported that they knew they were being fed talking points and a particular point of view, and that they were expected to go out and try to sell that argument. And in many cases, in most cases, it appears that they did. I would have to disagree with Michael Goldfarb, too, about something in terms of, you know, he's saying, oh, there was, you know, nobody cares. I'm not sure how we measure that at this point. I mean, I don't know if no one out in America, you know, is actually upset about this. I suspect some people are upset about it. So I'm not quite sure, like, who's measuring public opinion in terms of the reaction to this story.
Ken Silverstein of Harper is also with us. Michael Goldfarb of the Weekly Standard. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now here in the museum is Brian Duffy, managing editor of NPR News. As we mentioned earlier, one of the officers mentioned in the New York Times article was General Robert Scales, who was an analyst for NPR News. Brian, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Neil. It's good to be here.
And General Scales, was he on the NPR payroll?
Yes, General Scales was retained by NPR in February of 2003 and remained under contract with us for approximately a year. He's a distinguished general staff officer, and we used him to talk about maneuver tactics, talk about strategy, talk about the geography of the war and how the war was being prosecuted.
And was he vetted? Were his connections, including his military consultancies, questioned?
We are not sure at the time. He was affiliated with a defense contractor called Colgin, I believe, and we, as a matter of practice at NPR, everyone who appears as a guest on our air is asked a series of questions about real and apparent potential conflicts of interest. That was certainly the case with General Scales. We have found in a review since the Times article appeared that there was nothing that the general said to our listeners that was obviously related to or influenced by his outside interests or his participation in this program.
So, but in terms of transparency, were those contracts mentioned?
At the time, we did not know about those contracts, and as a result of that, there were a number of us very early Sunday morning exchanging a flurry of emails and phone calls, and as a result of that, we convened a meeting yesterday morning of everyone who's involved in every one of our news desks and every one of our shows to review our booking policies and practices, and to make sure that, you know, we enlist the assistance of our library staff and everyone else to do the kind of background check that ought to have been done in this case. Although in this case, we were fortunate in that the general conducted himself with, you know, great propriety and provided useful analysis to our listeners.
As I'm sure you know, NPR's ombudsman, Lisa Shepherd, has gotten a number of interesting questions about this, and she's been kind enough to share some of them with us.
Uh-huh.
From Mark, what is NPR's position on the past, present, and future use of Robert Scales as its military war commentator, given his exploitation by what the writer describes as a Pentagon PSYOPs program?
Well, I guess I would take issue with the word exploitation. As I said, in a review of our relationship with the general, we saw nothing to indicate that his remarks to our listeners were unduly influenced by his participation in this program or by any other of his relationships. So I have a little bit of trouble with the word exploitation, but I think the Times article sort of, knocked some of the scales from our eyes in terms of we ought to be increasingly vigilant. One of the things we will be doing, and it's underway, in fact, at this moment, is it's more the exception than the rule that we engage someone like General Scales as a paid consultant. We do it very, very seldomly, but when we do, we are drafting a more rigorous commentator agreement so that we will be aware of any kind of potential or apparent conflicts.
I should note you were not the managing editor at NPR at that time, but looking back on it now as you talk with other people who were in positions to make decisions, was this a mistake?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we would have liked to have known what the relationship was with any outside contractor, whether there was one. We certainly should have known that. So I'd say not really a mistake, but we could have exercised a bit more due diligence.
Brian Duffy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR Managing Editor Brian Duffy. Our thanks as well to Michael Goldfarb, the online editor at The Weekly Standard, with us from WBUR in Boston, and Ken Silverstein, Washington editor at Harper's Magazine, who joined us here at the museum in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Michael Yon, a citizen blogger who's just back from Iraq, who's probably spent more time embedded with American forces there than any other reporter. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.